I'm going to be giving a talk on thin flux tube model results. Even though this is the primary objective of this conference is to talk about observations, the thin flux tube models of active region evolution have been used to interpret a lot of the properties of active regions, and so I thought it was a nice topic to include in this conference. It doesn't mean that the model predictions are necessarily correct, but at least it's interesting. The work that I'm going to be describing has been done by quite a number of people, again, as a lot of whom are in this room. I'll try to give credit where credit is due when it comes up. So the question is, what can we learn about magnetic fields that are deep in the solar interior by studying the properties of active regions at the surface? And to try and answer that question, the approach we've taken is to use this semi-empirical theoretical model, thin flux tube models, to study how active regions evolve both in the solar interior and as they approach the surface through the solar convection zone. And then use those predictions to compare with observations, and by tweaking parameters such as the magnetic field strength and the amount of flux and where the magnetic fields originate in the solar interior, you can try to pin down some of the parameters like the magnetic field strength at the base of the solar convection zone. These are properties of magnetic fields that we think the thin flux tubes have had something to say. The field strength, the role of convective motions on active region orientation and evolution. This is somewhat speculative. We think the thin flux tube models might have something to say about why active regions, once they've emerged to the surface, appear to behave passively rather than dynamically. And they diffuse away and are carried by meridional flows. And also some work that Dana has done, and also Dick Canfield and Alex Petzoff, has something to say about how a modified version of the thin flux tube model might have something to say about where the global pattern of magnetic twists that we see in active regions might come from. These are features of active regions that we think we might be able to explain with thin flux tube dynamics. The equatorial gap in the distribution of active regions, some of the asymmetries between the leading and following sides of active regions, the variation in tilt angles is with latitude and with active region size. The variation of tilt angle with latitude has been given the name of Joy's Law, and I don't see Hal Zirn in the audience, but I think Hal Zirn was actually the first person, or was the person who named it Joy's Law in his book. The dispersion of tilt angles with active region size, which is work that that Dana and I did, the distribution of active region twists with latitude, that's work that Dick Canfield and Alex Petzoff and also Dana and I have worked on. And then something I won't be talking about in my talk, but Yuhong will be talking about, which is the properties of delta spot active regions. That's really not something you can deal with in the thin flux tube approximation. That's just why I decided not to talk about it myself. So why do we think that the concept of a flux tube is worthwhile? Well, this is a picture of Joe Blow emerging active region. And the main thing that you can see is that it's bipolar. There's some positive polarity, or maybe that's negative polarity, over here, the opposite polarity on the other side. And as these two sequences are taken a day apart, and as you see the two polarities separate, and so what we think is going on is that there's some loop of flux that has risen through the solar interior. We're basically just seeing the intersections of the flux with the photosphere. So we think that, roughly speaking, it's some kind of a tube-like structure that's just emerged through the solar interior. The untwisted thin flux tube models are probably the simplest treatment that you can do without doing a full-blown MHD simulation for the motions. And the idea is you make an ansatz that the magnetic flux is in tubes and it stays in tubes, and that you can substitute for the MHD equations an equation for this rope-like structure. And the dynamics are determined by a magnetic buoyancy force. And all these forces can be derived from the MHD equations themselves, with the exception of the aerodynamic drag force, which is a semi-empirical result. And there's lots of other physics that's swept under the rug here that I'm not going to go into. The idea is that you can take a very complicated three-dimensional problem and basically boil it down into a kind of a complicated one-dimensional problem. And it makes it much more tractable, although you're always left with the uncomfortable feeling that maybe you didn't get the physics right when you do this. But nevertheless, you can carry on. So the first thing I'm going to talk about, this is the third time we've seen this slide at this meeting, by the way, is
fourth.
Okay. So I'm not going to be talking about why the flux would migrate with latitude, but just simply to point out that there's a range of latitudes that you see magnetic flux at, and there's a gap near the equator, which is going to be the subject of the next couple of slides. And so the question is, what can we say about why should this gap exist? Now, the first thing that you have to consider with a thin flux tube model is not so much the I'll start off not by discussing the dynamics, but the initial equilibrium. And I guess Antonio is here. I think he was a co-author on the first paper I saw on this subject, which is what happens when you put a rubber band on a greasy tennis ball. Now, if the greasy tennis ball is not rotating, the rubber band just slips off to the poles. And so you can't actually have, and I should back up a little bit. Why do we talk about initially toroidal equilibria? It's just simply because it's the simplest geometry you can think of that explains Hale's polarity laws. You just think that the magnetic field is in some kind of a toroidal band. So anyway, if you have a rubber band on a greasy tennis ball, it just pops off the top. Now, if the rubber band is full of plasma and the tennis ball is rotating, as the rubber band tries to go up to the top, the Coriolis force induces a flow in it, and it prevents the rubber band from popping off the top. And so basically what they showed was that there is, depending on what your initial, if you were to start off with a flux tube that had exactly the same flow pattern as the surrounding plasma, that it will move to the north until it reaches an equilibrium where Coriolis forces balance magnetic tension forces. And it turns out that if the magnetic field strength is higher than around 10 to the fifth Gauss, that equilibrium is too far to the north to explain, it makes too big of an equatorial gap in the distribution of active regions if you assume the flux emerges radially. On the other hand, and Peter Gilman talked about this yesterday, if the field strength is too small, the flux tubes emerge straight, in this thing, straight north, and you wind up with magnetic flux coming way up high. So now it depends. If you believe all the premises here, you basically, just from this observation alone, you're stuck with a constraint that the magnetic field strength is somewhere between these two values. Maybe the premises are wrong, but that fact by itself leads you to that field strength constraint. The next subject I'm going to talk about is active region tilts and Joy's law. And this is a, what do we mean by active region tilts? This is how Bob Howard analyzed 25,000 spot groups taken since World War I from Mount Wilson. And this is how he defined a spot group, which is he tried to divide the sunspot group in half and then measured the distance between the two halves of the spot group and then measured the angle that line segment had with respect to the east-west direction, and in general it's tilted. And in fact, what he found and what Hale et al. Found was that this tilt is proportional to the sine of latitude. Should also point out that this figure also illustrates a few other things, which is we know that in the following side of active regions, the tube is more broken up as compared to the leading side. And also, one other thing I want to point out is that the the length of this line segment, Bob Howard found, is roughly proportional to the magnetic flux. And that's important because we're going to use that as a proxy later on here. So this is just, it turns out this is one of the big success stories of the thin flux tube model, is that for very reasonable choices of the magnetic field strength to the base of the convection zone, depending on the latitude, you can match the observations very well. Now, this line here is an average of the spot group tilt angles as a function of latitude. And I'll show you where that comes from in a little bit. And these are results from a calculation that Yuhong Fan and I did several years ago for different values of the field strength at the base of the convection zone. This was 30 kilogauss, 40, 50, 60, 78, and all the way up to 100 kilogauss for a 10 to the 22 Maxwell flux tube, which is about a typical active region size. And you can see that it fits very well. And the Moreno and Sirtis and Schussler and so et al. Have also found a very good agreement. They use slightly different initial conditions, but by and large, for very reasonable choices of the field strength, you can get, and the fluxes, you can get something that matches the observations pretty well. So what's going on? Why does this happen? Well, if you take a look, a side view of one of these emerging flux loops, roughly speaking, you'll find that there's a balance between upward forces driven by magnetic buoyancy and aerodynamic drag forces. And so you can estimate, using that force balance, you can estimate the value of velocity that the tube rises with. And in fact, of course, that's solved exactly, or not solved exactly, but that comes right out of the thin flux tube simulations. What we're trying to do here is to find a back of the envelope way of understanding those results. So now if you look at this from the top, what's going on? You find that the thin flux tube simulation said that it's tilted, and that the tilt is basically this angle right here. Well, why is that? That's because a rising expanding blob of plasma gets rotated clockwise in the northern hemisphere by the Coriolis force. And so you can balance the torque, you can estimate this by balancing the torque that Coriolis force provides this flux tube with a magnetic tension force. And when you do that, you find that the tilt angle is proportional to sine theta. And it's a new result. It's proportional to the flux to the 1/4 power. So since we have this big database of spot groups, we looked at the tilt angle as a function of d, which is a proxy for the magnetic flux. I don't know that that's d to the 1/4, but it's some slowly increasing function of d. And these are binned into high latitude, mid latitude, and low latitude spot groups. So you also see the increase with both d and theta. Now, this is the dirty secret. Yes, there's a Joy's law, this is all 25,000 spot groups plotted here, tilt angle versus sine theta. And you can see, yeah, okay, it's there, but there's a huge scatter. So that's sort of the dirty secret. Well, how big is that scatter, and what does that scatter depend on? We thought at first this was measurement errors of some kind, but it turns out that if you look at how Bob Howard analyzed the data, the likelihood of measurement error is actually pretty small. So we think that those are real tilt variations are due to the sun doing something. And when you look at the variation of tilt with other parameters like d, you found that it goes like d to the minus 3/4, roughly. But it was not a function of latitude. The obvious thing to try is to understand that in terms of perturbing the flux tube by convective turbulence. And so this is just a cartoon showing a flux tube emerging through a non-convecting convection zone, which is what we all do in the thin flux tube model. And and then what you might expect to happen if there was real turbulence going on, it's going to get messed up. And so Dana Longcope came up with a very nice Monte Carlo simulation of taking a flux tube through a stochastic model whose parameters were based on a simple mixing length theory, and just trying to see, well, how messed up does it get? And these are the tilt angle, these data points are the tilt angle dispersions as a function of d that we found from Howard's data. And these curves here are curves that Dana generated with messing up theory. And you can actually see that for reasonable values of the field strength, you can actually match the observations pretty well. Now, it's interesting to note that the value of the field strength that it takes to match this data is not exactly the same as the field strength it takes to match the tilt data. And there's lots of reasons why that could be, but the point is that it's reasonable.
The label is equal to the field strength at the bottom?
The label at the bottom here? Oh, yes, these are field strength at the bottom. Yes, that's correct. another great success of the thin flux tube models has been something that I think Fernando Moreno and Sirtis pointed out in 1994. And it's present in all the everyone had this in the simulations, which is, notice the shape of these emerging flux loops is not symmetric. And in fact, this is the direction of solar rotation. You see that it's bent the wrong way, or bent the opposite direction. And that's also a very simple consequence of the Coriolis force. As the stuff rises, it has its old angular momentum, and so it gets tilted in the retrograde direction. It's very simple. However, if you imagine drawing a line, or here's a line for this photosphere, you imagine emerging this structure through the photosphere, what would you expect to happen? You'd expect the spots that are on the leading side to move away a lot more faster than the spots on the following side. And that's, in fact, what's observed. And this is just a slide pointing out that I think it was Caligari, Moreno, and Sirtis, and Schussler wrote the paper that suggested this. And this is the only results from a 3D simulation I'll be showing here, but we've redone a calculation of emerging flux in a 3D simulation with rotation included, and we still find this exact same thing. So this is something that sort of validates that thin flux tube result. That's work that Bill Abbott did, by the way. Now, something, I think the first paper that Yuhong and I and Ed DeLuca wrote on thin flux tube models was trying to explain this asymmetry between the leading and the following side of active regions with thin flux tube models. And what we noticed in Yuhong's simulations was that the field strength along the leading side of the loop was a lot larger than the field strength on the following side. And that turns out the origin for that is basically shown in this cartoon. In those simulations that we did, as the tube emerges, the plasma drains out the bottom, but there's also the Coriolis force, which is introducing this retrograde flow that was responsible for the tilts. So what happens is here you get a much larger evacuation of plasma over here than you do here. And so the density goes down here, and the external gas pressure crunches in the tube, and the field strength goes up. And what we argued in there that the fact that the magnetic field strength is larger holds the flux tube together better in the face of convective turbulence and prevents it from being fragmented so much. Now, it turns out that this result is rather dependent on the field strength and the initial thermal conditions at the base of the convection zone. And it's not true when the field strengths are approaching 10 to the fifth Gauss. Furthermore, this model makes a prediction that you should see an upflow, or a relatively stronger upflow, or maybe perhaps a less strong downflow along the leading side of a loop as compared to the following side of a loop. Gianna Cauzi looked for this and found just the opposite. So I would say that the jury is somewhat out on that particular particular issue, though I think I still find the idea very appealing. So the next thing I'm going to talk about is we know that the fact that we have Hale's law, we see Hale's law and a Joy's law, suggests that when active regions emerge, it's communicating something about the underlying field in the convection zone. And yet, after active regions emerge, they tend to just fall apart in a way that you can model very well by just simply advection and diffusion of the magnetic flux. This is an example of an active region in four successive solar rotations. It's getting more and more smeared out. And all the work that Neil Shealy has done on modeling large-scale magnetic fields says advection and diffusion works just fine. So how can these two pictures be reconciled with one another? And so back in 1994, Yuhang and I were trying to understand why our code crashed some of the time when we were trying to emerge the active regions. What we discovered was the following. If you consider the solar convection zone and you ignore convection, then if there's hydrostatic equilibrium, then you have the pressure stratification looks something like this blue line in a schematic kind of way. Now, the temperature structure in the convection zone is super adiabatic because it's convecting. However, a flux tube that's rising in a month or two will emerge pretty much adiabatically because the radio diffusion is not effective on that kind of time scale. And so if you plot what would happen if you emerge plasma adiabatically with a lower pressure, gas pressure that you have inside a flux tube, you get something like a green curve. So if you if you have a small flux tube and you let it rise up, it'll rise up very close to hydrostatic equilibrium, and right once it gets to about this point, say the photosphere is up here, the code blows up. And that's just because the thin flux tube approximation doesn't work anymore. The Moreno and Sirtis et al. Have given this the name flux tube explosion. We were not so much interested in the case of the explosion as we were what happens. Our idea was in large flux tubes, this doesn't happen. That's just because we're way out of hydrostatic equilibrium. So our idea is for what we call dynamic disconnection is that first, the tube emerges way out of hydrostatic equilibrium, emerges all the way up to the surface. By the way, I have to give credit to Lorraine Lundquist, who made these very nice figures for a talk that she gave on dynamic disconnection. It emerges all the way up into the through the photosphere into the corona, you get coronal loops. And then it tries to establish hydrostatic equilibrium. And at the depth where you can't do that anymore, the magnetic field then blows apart. And so over the space of several weeks, you get the fields at the surface become what we call dynamically disconnected. And basically it just means the field strength down here becomes very weak. And so it's no longer, the surface fields are no longer dynamically connected to the evolution in the interior. So now I'm going to talk about twist and active regions. This is a subject Alex Petzoff and Dick Canfield worked on. Took a look at the distribution, try to do a fit of the average twist of an active region, do this for active regions all over the surface of the sun. What they found is this plot here, this is latitude on this axis, and this is a measure of their fit to the twist of each active region. And roughly speaking, the twist is there's a small but real change in the average sign of the twist. It's positive in the southern hemisphere and it's negative in the northern hemisphere. This is the width of that distribution about that line. So where does this come from? And so now I'm going to talk about some work that Dana Wonkope and Isaac Clapper did. It turns out that if you have a small amount of twist, you can actually take the same thin flux tube equations and add some parasitic equations that are kinematic equations that describe the evolution of twist and you can just add these post facto to the thin flux tube equations. And so the new variables here are omega, which is basically an angular frequency of rotation of the flux tube, and Q just describes the amount of twist at the field line twist at a given time. We write b theta as qrbz. So it turns out you get these two equations that couple omega and q together. And there's this funny term here that Dana is called sigma. And it involves the tangent vector of the flux tube and the curvature vector. And it's dotted into the derivative of the velocity along the tube arc length. So what is this? Well, it turns out that this is a description of how magnetic helicity changes form between local twist in the flux tube and the writhe of the flux tube axis. And so, for example, the derivative of the twist of the flux tube is, since the magnetic helicity in ideal MHE is conserved, is minus the time derivative of the writhe. That's equal to the line integral of this sigma term along the tube. And so what happens then, if you take a Joy's law tube that's being twisted like this, it will induce a writhe like that. It will induce a twist of the opposite sign in the tube. So initially we were thinking, well, look, we know that flux tubes get writhed like this because of Joy's law. So maybe this twist that Dick and Alex were seeing in active regions was due to this effect. Well, Dana estimated the magnitude of this, and it's down by, was it one or two orders of magnitude? Two orders of magnitude from what's observed. However, we just remembered that we had done these simulations of how flux tubes get messed up by convection, and so Dana decided to try and make an estimate of the writhe due to that convective turbulence using a reasonable, though unproven, hypothesis about the amount of kinetic helicity that you'd expect based on the Rossby number and assuming it goes as cosine theta. And I think Antonio was pointing out yesterday that's an act of faith. No one has really proven that, but I think it's reasonable. And so here's what we found. These are the data again, and that theoretical model gives you this solid curve, and that agrees, that's right in the same ballpark as what we see in the data. And the theory also tells you the fluctuations in the twist, which is these dashed lines here. And you can see it's maybe a bit larger than the data, but it's not unreasonable. It looks like I'm going to maybe conclude early, which might be good. So I would say thin flux tube models have provided us with a useful tool for understanding active region dynamics and constraints, but I think really to go much further, we need to start doing 3D MHD simulations. And I'll stop.
We have plenty of time for questions, so cut.
Very pretty models. When you come up with a dispersion theory, it's a messed up idea, and that agrees pretty well. What do the models say about maybe the tendency and the rate at which things could come up on the high or low side of the mean tilt angle want to go back to the mean?
We didn't address that here, but I think Dana and Arnab Chowdhury did an investigation of this.
If I could, I'll answer the question.
Go for it.
There was a puzzling observation by Bob Howard that showed that active regions that emerge at an angle different from Joy's law will relax to Joy's law on an average time scale of about 4 days, or relax towards Joy's law. They basically looked at the time rate of change versus the angle itself. He sort of interpreted this as saying maybe Joy's law really isn't due to the Coriolis force at all. It might be due to tension. Maybe all the fields are anchored in a way that makes them want to spring back to Joy's law. But we looked at this model a little more carefully and realized that was a natural consequence of the fact that Joy's law is induced by the Coriolis force on a very large scale. The whole flux tube gets distorted. And that the deviations are induced on much shorter scales by turbulence. And the turbulent perturbations propagate as kink waves or Alfvén waves, and the frequency is proportional to the wave number, inversely proportional to the wavelength. So the frequency of relaxation for the short perturbations is very small, whereas for the large flux tube length distortions, it takes more like a month for those to propagate away. So that actually...
So it's still communicating. It's deep, and eventually it realizes that the convection is disordered from where it wants to be.
Well, from where the largest scale. Yes. So does that answer your question?
Yes.
And I might also, if I could make my own point, point out that the 4 days then gives you some handle on dynamic disconnection. Because if you were disconnected at a depth that was shallower than a 4 day commute down to the point of disconnection, then you couldn't have a 4 day relaxation time scale. It'd be much shorter. So if there's disconnection, it must be deeper than 4 days.
I'll follow up for a second.
Okay.
Can you explain something about this relaxation back to the mean? Does it also say anything about what should happen to the felicity of the mean during that time?
Excellent question. We don't know. We don't know yet. That's a different kind of the Forgeron family propagating.
I have a couple questions. First is about heliocyte, but they're both up. How good is a thin flux tube approximation really physically? And the first is about heliocytology. To what extent does time distance heliocytology really show you the structure? Imagine what you think that should be there. And that's the second question. So, second question is, I thought we learned yesterday from Ake that the buoyancy is out the window. So why do these things arise in the first place?
Well, I think Aki would disagree with that. He's just saying that it has to get a lot more buoyant than you thought they would before buoyancy will overpower this turbulent pumping. The answer to the first question, Sasha Kosovichev and the folks at Stanford are really trying very hard to look and see if they see omega loops with time distance helioseismology. And is Doug Brown in the audience somewhere? So maybe you can comment on that.
Well, I'll be getting a talk in about 10 minutes.
Okay.
I have sort of two problems with this basic concept.
Only two?
And the first two. The first one has to do with nature never has closed field lines.
Yeah, I also have a problem with assuming that the field is toroidal. There's really no reason to assume that other than simplicity. You're completely right
but
about
the
that.
The other problem is sort of related. Suppose that we accept then that this is, equilibrium is established by the flow in the tube. But then when the tube breaks up, the flow is stopped. It's cancelled. So then the tendency to flow towards the pole should set in.
Sorry?
The tendency to flow towards the pole by the tension that this whole thing was supposed to stop.
Yeah, I think
I think that
to answer that question, what you really need to do is include a wound up field line, have the tube not be toroidal, but to have it wrapped around the sun a bunch of times like we think it probably is.
Yes, exactly, and I think maybe then we'll find a problem.
Well, if we find a problem, well, that's good because we have jobs to do. So
that's exactly the point. This has been a successful concept now for a number of years, and we should start to ask what are the limits of it.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Totally agree with you. Not necessarily, and when they emerge fragmented, I mean, I think it could be a dynamic effect that doesn't have anything to do with dynamic disconnection, but it does provide an explanation for why the surface evolution models that Wang and Shealy and a lot of other people use are so successful, and they just totally ignore all magnetic forces in those models. It's just like paint, diffusion of paint.
Okay, maybe this is the same part of the question. I'm going to ask whether that your model has anything to say about the rate at which diffusion of the field occurs at the surface, or is that...
In fact, is Lorraine Lundquist in the audience somewhere? Yes, she is. So that's exactly what she's been working on, which is one of our hypotheses is that the turbulent diffusion rate is not controlled by turbulent diffusion at the surface, but at this layer where the dynamic disconnection occurs, and it should in fact be higher, though whether it's enough higher to explain the observations is not clear yet.
Peter, all of them on the point of reestablishing equilibrium. I don't think you have to use Coriolis force necessarily to do that. If you could rearrange the mass a little bit in Teflon, for example, so if the hydrostatic pressure forward of the ring is a little higher, you get a latitudinal pressure gradient which can hold it in place.
Okay. So this is it's an argument, I guess.
In the stable stratigraphy, it doesn't take very much to do that for a ring of that strength. I was a little puzzled by your emphasis on why you think that's is maybe difficult to explain.
Well, I mean, it's not that it's difficult to explain, but I think it's a constraint.
Right, but if you consider the combination of the fact that the toroidal field obviously changes sign somewhere around the equator, and therefore goes through low values, plus lower values, if they come out at all, are going to come out diverging away from the equator, it seems to me hard to avoid it.
That's a good point. It's a good point. Yep.
Maybe going back to the dynamic disconnection, we know from observations that there are some spots which survive several solar rotations. How do you explain?
I think you may be in more trouble than you know with this retrograde flow in an active region. There's not only the Cosby paper, but I believe there's one that Canfield was the principal author on, and you were a co-author, that looked at three regions and found in the three different regions that the flow was not retrograde but prograde.
Yeah, that's
what we've been analyzing also comes up with a prograde.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, turns out the referee of that paper was Antonio, I think. And Antonio pointed out that there's another possible explanation. If the field strength is more like 10 to the fifth Gauss and there is this prograde flow, and if that flow persists all the way up to the top of the loop, you could in fact get the sign that was observed rather than the sign that you know we said should happen from. So that's why I said the jury's out on that one.
Lawrence, can you comment a little bit on any possible impact from the differential flow due to the changing rotation law in the convective zone? So you didn't. The question, there's a change in the mean flow.
Yeah, in fact, actually, one of the, Yuhong and I did write a paper in which we actually put in the differential rotation of the sun. And it certainly changes things in detail. You find that it changes the latitudes of emergence by 5 or 10 degrees. It does not change the global picture all that much.
Eric, I had a couple of quick questions. One was, The expressions for aerodynamic drag.
Yeah.
I mean, that would presumably be stronger in a convecting turbulent medium.
Well, actually, the expression that we used was one that's is typically invoked for Reynolds numbers of millions, and I don't think once you get past the drag coefficient is a function of Reynolds number. It goes up and down, but once you get past 10,000 or something like that, it tends to stay pretty flat. So I'm not so much worried about that. I think the bigger problem is the fact that an emerging buoyant flux tube will establish vortices alongside them. The vortices have large forces associated with them, and all of that swept under the rug in the thin flux tube model.
But with the values that you use at the moment, what kind of speeds do you get then?
Roughly speaking, you get the rise speed is the ratio of the tube radius to the pressure scale height times the Alphane speed.
Okay,
if you do that balance.
But for a typical active region,
it basically takes about 2 months to go from the base of the convection zone to the top. Almost all of that is spent near the bottom, and then it goes zoop, less a little bit.
The other question, I don't quite understand your dynamic disconnection.
Okay, the assumptions are this. If you assume hydrostatic equilibrium in the background envelope, if you assume hydrostatic equilibrium in the flux tube itself, and if you assume pressure confinement of the tube, you get a contradiction in terms. And that's simply because the convection zone is super adiabatically stratified. The temperature dies off more quickly than adiabatic. And so what happens is the external pressure dies, can actually switch sign, or the difference in pressure can become negative, in which case the assumptions are just wrong. That's what
it
was.
The flux tube is the perfect ascending block.
Sorry?
The flux tube is the perfect ascending.
Yeah, the flux tube, yeah, right, that's right. And it just says that your assumption that it can be in hydrostatic equilibrium, this isn't true. Yes.
Then these cascades, the line is the heavens of the upper hemisphere pattern.
Well, in fact, if you believe that tilts are a sign of that rise, then it's true.
But do you have any observational evidence for the Coriolis iron rise in equilibrium?
Observational evidence for what now?
Rise.
Well, since you can't see the whole tube, you can only see the surface of it. The only, the simplest diagnostic is just simply the tilt itself. And the tilt, a positive tilt angle would imply a positive rise in the northern hemisphere.
So if you see a seamount-like structure, in structure, I think that there should be a difference in terms of rise, right?
I think we've got one of the world's experts on the sigmoid structures right here, Dick Canfield. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, you can't apply the concept of rise to a coronal structure like that without quite a bit of care. The framework in which George discussed it here is that within the thin flux tube framework, in which the axis is a well-defined quantity and motion of that, or the displacement of that axis from a straight line, is well defined. And once you get into the corona, well, you can distinguish twist rise. In fact, you're going to talk about it in your talk, and you will discuss how you use a real magnetogram, for example, to distinguish your college, but further, not further field. Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yes, may I comment again on the dynamic disconnection, but okay. It's too much. Just one point. I think you should revise the time scale, because we have active regions which produce CMEs for several solar rotations. The source of CMEs cannot come, the source of helicity carried in CMEs cannot come from the differential rotation. It is too little, the input. It should come from below, and this can only come if the flux tube lasts zero connected.
I guess another way of looking at that is, don't you think that there's still new flux emerging in these long-lived active regions that you see?
There could be some, but I believe, we studied active regions, there was no evidence of such amount of flux emergence which could explain. So I would say, in fact, maybe in most of the active regions, it is
more. I guess I don't understand what the consequences of this lack of equilibrium in the model with those assumptions.
Well, basically, what
one consequence could be that, the tube expands, it's no longer thin. Another could be that you get flows along the tube, it's no longer.
Yeah, and in fact, the consequences are not so clear, actually. I mean, it's certainly very clear that the assumptions are not self-consistent. There's this concept of flux tube explosion that Fernando Moreno and Curtis has proposed. That the tube reaches that height and then it tries to suck plasma up from below, and then the field strength gets strongly concentrated. And I think there's some fellow named Rempel, I think, who's now doing numerical simulations of this. And I think, in other words, the consequences are something that require a lot more investigation than just what you can do with a thin flux tube model.
All the questions George will have to be able to answer. Next, we're going to.
Or that I want to answer.
That you want to answer, right. A few more than you probably wanted to answer. Next, we'll have Doug Brown, who will.
Yes, I would.
Tell us about helioseismic observations of these things. So we've heard the very beautiful theory. Now we can do the real.
Yeah, right.